much, Ellie, for the introduction. Okay, so first of all, I'm very happy to be here. It's my first visit to Perimeter, and it's obviously it's a terrific place to do research, so thanks a lot for having me. So my name is Jędrzej Kaniewski. I'm from the Polish Academy of Sciences in Warsaw. I thought that instead of giving you presenting one particular result, I think it's maybe more helpful, more useful to just give an overview of the field. And so I will try to give you a brief introduction to the whole idea of self-testing, and then also discuss some recent developments. The selection of topics that I will cover is very subjective, so it's kind of strongly influenced by my own interests. But I kind of want to say that this reflects what at least the physics part of the community interested in self-testing is working on. So that should be representative. And in fact, I'm here for another week and a half, so I'm until the end of next week. So there's plenty of time to talk. If you have any questions or comments, then please come and find me. And since I don't really know what your background is, please feel free to interrupt any time, and I'm happy to take questions either during the talk or after the talk or anytime you see me. Okay, so I guess maybe I'll just give you a very quick outline of the talk. So to start with self-testing, we first need to know what Bell non-locality is, and I guess most of you have seen non-locality stuff, but just to make sure that we have all the basic notions at hand, I'm just going to give you a very brief introduction to non-locality. And then I'm going to tell you about self-testing of two-qubit systems. So these are in some sense like the basic self-testing results that exist. And we will briefly discuss these. And of course, after this, you should already understand what is the idea of self-testing, and then there is plenty of questions how to generalize it to more complicated scenarios. So I guess the last one will just be generalizations. Okay, so this is the outline. And I guess I'm gonna just start with non-locality. Okay. So I guess most of you have heard of non-locality. The usual Bell scenario is we have two devices. We can choose different measurement settings and obtain measurement outcomes. So X and Y are the settings, and A and V are the outcomes. A priori, we don't know anything about these systems. So in some sense, this is the setup. Okay? You have some two unknown systems. The only thing you know is that you can choose measurement settings. You get some outcomes, and the only thing that you have access to in this setup are the joint probability distributions. Okay, so we kind of assume that you can perform the experiment many times. You can collect statistics, and also you kind of assume that every time you do this experiment, the devices behave in the same way, so that this is a well-defined object. Okay, so these probabilities exist, and you can estimate them to arbitrary precision. Of course, in real world, this is not quite the case, so there is an extra problem. But I guess from the point of view of self-testing, it's just very convenient to assume that these probabilities exist and they are well-defined.
You assume that X and Y can be chosen independently, right?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Indeed. So. So you're welcome. You can choose the measurement settings independently, and I guess for the purpose of this talk, I'm assuming that both the measurement settings and the possible outcomes, they come from finite sets. Okay, this is just to keep things simple. Okay, and I guess in this setup, you can ask. Okay, so as I said, we don't really know what these devices are. But I guess you can have different models for what they could be, okay? And I guess the first model that you can think about is the classical model. So what can classical devices do? And I guess it's by now pretty well accepted that what we mean by classical is really this notion of local hidden variable models or local realistic models in which Okay, let me just write the formula. Okay. Okay. So this is the standard like formulation of local realism. So essentially, we're saying, look, if we forget about this summation over lambda, we just get some kind of okay. So these are some kind of local response functions. Okay. So for every value of the parameter lambda and for every input of x, Alice has just some distribution over the outcomes. And similar, Bob has some distribution over the outcomes for every value of his input and the parameter. And then taking the summation over lambda just corresponds to taking a convex combination of these. And you know, this is kind of what we think that classical systems are able to do. Okay, so essentially classical systems, they are correlated through some classical random variable, but otherwise they just do kind of independent strategies locally. Okay, and I'm going to call distributions that can be written in this way, they are called local, and the set of such distributions we denote by L. This is just the local set, okay? Okay, so this is for let's say local device, well, local classical devices, okay? This is like we assume that this is the correct description of classical devices, okay? And then, of course, you can ask what is possible in quantum mechanics. And in quantum mechanics, we know that these two devices could be sharing a state, possibly an entangled state, and could be performing some local measurements on that state. So in principle, there is much more you can do. Okay? So we say, well, in quantum, the distributions I can observe are of this form. Okay, so what I need is some kind of bipartite state, rho AB, and some kind of local measurements. Okay, so when I write PAX, X is the measurement setting, A is the outcome for Alice, and similar for Bob. So I need local measurements and a state, and then you know the probabilities are computed according to the Born rule, and you know, and I say that a distribution of this form can be achieved in quantum mechanics, and the set of such distributions, I denote by Q. Okay, so this is the quantum set of correlations. And of course, you can ask, okay, what is the relation between the local set and the quantum set? And it is actually pretty clear that the local set is a subset of Q. Okay, so everything that you can achieve in this model, you can also achieve in this model. And I guess you know, the great discovery of Bell was that these sets are actually different. Okay, so the quantum set is strictly bigger than the local set. Okay, so in some sense, this is I would say this is like the founding relation of Bell non-locality. Noticing that in quantum you can do more than in classical, and of course, once you realize that you can do more, you can ask, okay, how much more can I do, and how to quantify it. Okay, And I guess initially people were mainly interested in you know, certifying that what is happening in their experiment is not classical. So I guess they were interested in finding so proving that certain observed correlation does not belong to the local set, okay? And because it's kind of easy to see that both the local set and the quantum sets, they are just kind of convex bodies. So if you have, so maybe just to give you some intuitive picture. So the local set is actually a polytope, because when you think about all these strategies that you can come up with here, you can always decompose them as deterministic strategies. Okay, so although in principle these response functions could be probabilistic, you can always shift all the randomness into the lambda, and then you just end up with deterministic strategies. So this set is actually a polytope. Okay. So geometrically, this would be my This would be my local set. And then, you know, the quantum set is something that it's a convex object, which is slightly bigger, okay? And I guess now I'm interested in, and I observed some point somewhere, and I wanna convince myself that it does not belong to the local set. And of course, the easiest thing to do is to find a separating hyperplane, okay? So if I find a hyperplane like this, and I realize that, okay, the whole local set lies on one side of it, and I have a point, for example, here, which is on the other side of it, then I have a very easy to verify certificate that my point is not local. Okay, does not belong to the locals. And in the context of non-locality, these hyperplanes are just Bell inequalities. Okay, and Bell inequality is nothing else than just a linear functional. So, you know, I can think of this. So my correlations or my probability point. This is just a vector of numbers, a vectors of real numbers, okay? Where, okay, the number of entries depends on the number of inputs and the number of outputs, but this is just a real vector. And so what I can do, I can just, you know, think about linear functionals on this space of vectors, and these are precisely my Bell functionals, okay? So when I have, okay, so when I my Bell functional is really just a collection of numbers which are labeled by the inputs and the outputs. Okay, so it's basically the same length as the probability vector, and I assume that these are all real numbers. And then I can just define some kind of inner product between my Bell expression and my probability point. And this is just the standard inner product. Okay. And then I guess once I've picked a Bell expression, which is just determined by these coefficients, I can ask, okay, so what is the largest value of this Bell expression, of this Bell functional, that I can achieve over the local set? Okay, so this will just be, so this is called the local value of the Bell expression, of the Bell functional, and it's just defined as the, let's say, the supremum over the points in L. And now I just have the inner product of BNP, okay? Since actually the local set is a polytope, so this is actually a maximum, but I guess I just want to leave it here to make it look similar to what I'm going to write for the quantum set. And then, of course, if I find a point and I compute this inner product and I find that I get more than beta L, then I know that I'm not local, okay? So this is just a way, or a very simple certificate that what I see is not consistent with a classical model. Okay. And I guess analogously, we can define the quantum value of a Bell expression, which will be just the same, except that now we take the supremum over the quantum points. Okay. And of course, for our purposes, the interesting case is when these two numbers are different. So for the whole purpose of this talk, we will only look at functionals for which the quantum value is strictly bigger, like in this example. Okay. Okay. So I think okay. So maybe I just want to say one more thing about this non-locality business. So note that in the quantum case, when I evaluate this inner product, so I have the sum over CA, B, X, Y, and the probabilities. But since the probabilities are computed according to the top equation, so we have these measurement operators, I can define something which is called the Bell operator. Okay, so the Bell operator, I'm going to denote it by W, for a particular Bell functional is just the sum of, so I take the coefficients, and then I multiply them by the measurement operators, Okay? And the Bell operator has this property that when I want to compute the value of my functional on a particular quantum realization, it suffices to just compute the Bell operator and then take the trace of the Bell operator with my state. Okay? It's just a different way of writing. And instead of first computing the probabilities and then taking a linear combination of them, I'm going to first compute the operator and then finally trace everything. Okay? So it's just a change of order. But what is kind of convenient about these Bell operators is that in the cases that we will consider here, they're kind of nice and easy to write down. And because they are in one-to-one correspondence with the functional, so if I specify the Bell operator, although it looks like it's a quantum object, and indeed it's a quantum object, it really it uniquely defines a functional. So then you can also ask about what is the classical or what is the local value of this Bell operator. So I'm gonna be working in the language of operators just because it's easy to specify them. Yes.
Can you get some intuition about how complex this polytope is, and yeah.
Yes. So it.
Facets it has. Whatever.
Yeah. So it's pretty complex.
Mm-hmm.
So
the
local polytope. Yeah. So if you ask, okay. So this is a very valid question. So if you ask how many strategies are there here, there is a lot, because basically, okay, what is a deterministic strategy? A deterministic strategy is, for Alice, for every input, she has to give a particular output. So it's like a function from the set of inputs to the set of outputs, okay? And there is just, when the number of inputs and outputs grow, there is actually a lot of such functions. So so it's exponential in one of them in the size of, okay, I don't remember what it is, but it's exponential in one of them. And then you also have
inputs.
Okay, so it's exponential in the number of inputs, and also you have two of them. So the number of vertices of this polytope grows pretty fast, and so does the number of facets. Okay. So I guess one of the problems is that although I guess what we really want are these facets, because they are kind of certificates of non-classicality, and we just don't know how to compute them. Okay, because already listing the vertices is expensive because there is a lot of them, whereas then there are some kind of techniques known how to go from vertices to facets, but we just don't know how to do them efficiently. So I think we can only solve these polytopes in terms of compute the facets for the simplest scenarios, where you have a couple of inputs and a couple of outputs on each side. Once you go beyond that, there's just too many of them. So indeed, like finding facet Bell inequalities is a tough thing. And I guess people don't believe that there isn't like an efficient way of generating all of them. Yeah. Okay, so this is the Bell operator. Okay, so I think I'm basically done with non-locality. So maybe one thing I want to say is that, oh yes, sorry.
Okay, so do you know what's the relation between these operators and entanglement witnesses?
Yes. Okay. So entanglement witnesses. Okay, you also construct them like this, but these operators are kind of fixed. Okay, whereas in the Bell case, this can be any measurement. And this can be any measurement. So in some sense, the non-locality case is a bit harder because I'm not really assuming anything about the measurements. Okay. So when I write this suprema here, for example, the quantum supremum. So basically, I'm maximizing over both the measurements and the state. Okay. And then I can show that whatever state you choose, whatever measurement you choose, you can only get up to some value.
You're defining that with the C. Okay.
Yeah, for entanglement witnesses, these would be fixed operators, and then you compute the maximum over separable state or something. So in some sense, non-locality is a bit harder to analyze because I have this extra freedom that I don't really know how to. It's harder to deal with. Okay.
But this W is an entanglement witness, right?
Sorry.
This W is an entanglement witness.
Yes, but the other way around doesn't work. So like not every entanglement witness can be turned into a Bell expression, because some of them, once you allow different measurements, they kind of become trivial.
Yeah, there's a difference between non-locality and entanglement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess also like non-locality works at the level of correlations, whereas entanglement works at the level of states. So it's really because in non-locality, I take my state, and then I have to perform some measurement, but it can be any measurement, and then I see where I can get. So okay, but that's so there is some relation, but it's.
But this W kind of makes that relation clear, right? Because this acts on the W the state row.
Well, okay, it acts on the state row, but I mean, you know, I can, you know, whenever I write things like this, I don't know anything about row, and I don't know anything about the measurements, not even the dimension. So in that sense, like this really describes the set of correlations.
Yeah.
And it's really not clear like how the set of correlations is related to the set of states.
Right.
Okay. So, but it's okay. So look. So I guess traditionally Bell non-locality was used to indeed perform. You would do an experiment. You measure something, and then you want to certify that what you see does not have a classical model. Okay. So I guess the traditional way of using Bell of doing Bell test was that okay, you do the experiment, you observe some p, so this is just some probability point, and you figure out that this p does not belong to the local set, for example by finding a Bell inequality which is violated, and from this you can conclude that my system does not admit a local realistic description. Okay, so this was like in a sense, you're just saying what my system isn't. Okay, it cannot be classical or local realistic. Okay, whereas I guess what I'm interested in is kind of pushing this argument one step further. So in order to do this, you need to kind of have more assumptions. Okay, so my extra assumption, or like the self-testing assumption, is that what I see comes from measuring a quantum system. Okay. So I kind of assume that my p belongs to the quantum set. Okay, so there is some state and some measurements that give me this. And then again, I see that it does not belong to the local set. So it's quantum, but not local. Okay, and this allows me to certify quantum properties of the quantum realizations, okay? So I kind of assume I have some quantum realization, so I have some state, and I have some measurements on it. And now, just from the statistics, which are non-local, I wanna certify some properties of these quantum objects, okay? So in some sense, you see that, well, in the first case, you cannot really make any constructive conclusions because you really don't have a clue what your system is. You can only say what it isn't. Whereas once you assume, well, it's a quantum system, and then you see something non-local, then you can actually certify quantumness inside your realization. Okay?
I'm a bit uncertain of your point.
Yeah.
So are you assuming that in the first implication, your system may not be described by quantum mechanics?
In here?
Yeah.
Yeah? Well, I mean, so in the usual Bell setup, okay, you observe some correlations, and then you want to draw some conclusion. And the only thing you can do is like, well, if my system was governed by the local hidden variable model, I couldn't have got these correlations. So this is wrong. So this means that it cannot be classical. But can you conclude what it is? Is it quantum? Is it a more general theory? No. So in some sense, like if you want to conclude something about your system, you kind of have to fix what is the playing field. Like what is my system even allowed to be? Because if you don't assume anything, then it can be any.
Maybe you have some extra constraints imposed on, you know, theories consistent with quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
So you could test those restrictions.
Correct.
And you could certify that, you know, your premise of the implication in the second line is satisfied, right? That P belongs to Q.
So when I wrote this, okay, maybe this was a shorthand. I really meant that this comes from measuring a quantum system. So there is some quantum realization in the background, which I just don't know what it is, but it's a valid quantum realization. And from this, I can draw some conclusion. Of course, if you don't want to assume quantum, you want to assume a more general class of theories, you can do it. But I guess I really don't know what kind of conclusions you can. Yeah, so I don't really know much about the beyond quantum theories. But I guess this, I mean, it makes sense to ask these questions. I just wouldn't know what kind of conclusions you could draw. Okay, and so maybe the last comment. So this is basically the spirit of self-testing, and now I'm going to show you a couple of examples of how it works. And maybe just on a historical note, so the first results of this kind, they can be really traced back to like very early days. So already in the papers of Cyrilson in the 80s, and there was a paper by Summers and Werner, and then Popescu and Rolich in the early 90s, they already knew this. Well, they already had examples of this, okay? But somehow, I feel that the way these early papers were phrased, they were phrased in a way, well, I have this Bell inequality, and the only way to maximally violate it is this way, okay? Full stop. Whereas then there was the, let's say, the important work of Myers and Yao in 1998, in which they made the same statement, but they interpreted it differently, because they said, look, if I observe the maximum violation, then I know what state I have, and I know what measurements I'm doing, okay? So they, I mean, it's really like, logically it's equivalent, but it's just a different way of understanding it. And then you realize, well, so actually these Bell violations, they allow me to certify stuff, okay? And I think this was kind of important because then, I mean, from this, you can also, you can say, okay, so I have these unknown quantum devices, but if they give me the right statistics, I actually know what they are, more or less. And maybe I can use them for something useful. So this self-testing, like the certification aspect, was something new. And I guess, it's closely related, for example, to device-independent cryptography, because that's also the setup. You have unknown devices. You're trying to do something useful with them. How do you know that you can do it? Well, because they exhibit non-local correlations. And these non-local correlations kind of tell you what's happening inside, even if a priori you didn't know anything, okay? So the first results very early, and then the certification aspect only became apparent at the end of the 90s. And then since then, people kind of were developing a bit of this and this device-dependent crypto, and it all goes together. But actually, I would say that the last 5 years have been really great for the field. So we have developed a lot of new results, and we're really starting to understand what's happening in this world. Okay. Okay. So I guess this finishes part one of the talk. So this is the non-locality stuff, and now I'm just going to go straight to the second part, which is self-testing of two-qubit systems. And I'm just going to give you examples, and hopefully with the examples it should be kind of clear what is the general theme of the field. Okay. So in all my examples, I'm going to just talk about scenarios where there are two outcomes, okay? And we know that, so if I give you a measurement, so I just have two operators, F0 and F1, and they are positive, and they add up to identity, okay? So this is a measurement with two outcomes, and I know that such a measurement can be conveniently described by an observable, where I just take the difference of the two guys, okay? And so now this A, A is a Hermitian operator, which is between identity and minus identity, and it's just a very convenient way of describing a measurement with two outcomes, and for the rest of this talk, I'm just gonna always use this observable description instead of writing the measurement operators, okay? And I want to start with the I guess most famous Bell inequality, which is the CHSH inequality, for which the Bell operator is defined like this. I'm sure you have seen this before. Okay. And okay, so this is just a Bell operator, but it's equivalent to a Bell functional, and you can ask, okay, what is the local value of this Bell functional? What is the quantum value? And I guess it's well known that the local value is 2, and it's kind of easy to check. The quantum value is 2√2, and again, this is actually a result from Cyrilson from the 80s. And then you can ask, okay, so this is the maximum value. How do I achieve this value? Okay, and it turns out that I want to write this down, but I'm going to move to the other side. So,
I think you have also one other layer of blackboard behind this.
Oh, really? Okay, but then is it... so I don't have to erase them, you're saying. Okay. Okay, oh, so many blackboards. yes?
The CH inequality.
Yeah.
Those A's and B's are usually like X and Z.
Exactly.
But here you didn't specify them.
Yeah. So okay. So exactly. So the point is like when you define the Bell functional, you don't specify what your measurements are. Somehow like this the two values, the local value and the quantum value, they are valid for all choices of observables. Okay. But of course, if you want to actually maximally violate it, then you have to choose them wisely. In fact, if you want to violate it at all. And indeed, so the canonical choice of observables for this. For this inequality, well, the one that gives you the maximum violation, okay, you choose the first observables of Alice to be x, the second one to be z, the observables of Bob, they look like they are just linear combinations of x and z. Okay, and the state that you have to choose is the maximally entangled state of two qubits. Okay, and then if you do the calculation, so if you construct the Bell operator out of these guys, and then you take a trace with this state, you will find that you violate CHSH maximally. Okay, and I guess okay, so this is interesting. But then it turns out that this is essentially the only way of violating it maximally, okay? And so basically, I want to say, well, if I have an unknown system, you know, and I perform some unknown measurements on it, well, if I see the statistics that give me the violation of 2√2, the maximum violation, then I basically know what's happening. And I would kind of like to say that what's happening is this, except that there are some kind of trivial equivalences that I have to take care of, okay? And the first thing that I do not see when I just look at the correlations are kind of extra degrees of freedom, okay? So it could be the case that my state, instead of just being psi plus, it is actually some psi plus. So there are two qubits on each, one qubit on each side, but there's also some junk state, okay, on Alice and Bob, which kind of gets measured in a trivial way, okay? So then I have to add identities everywhere here, just to show that Alice and Bob, in the end, they don't care about the junk state; they just perform the measurements on the qubits, okay? So this is one equivalence I have to take care of. But of course, the other equivalence is that if I apply some local unitary both to the measurement operators and to the state, this will not affect the statistics. But of course it looks different at the level of realization. So I also have to add some local unitaries. So this is the unitary for Alice. This is the unitary for Bob. And of course I have to kind of add the same unitary to this guy, where this U is just the product of UA and UB. Okay, so in some sense, so this is my unknown state, rho AB. Okay, so basically if I see beta equals 2√2, I can deduce all these things.
The unitary in the state is the inverse of the product.
No, I think it's the same actually. No, because if you put in like an A in front of here, then it will be the dagger that will hit this. So I think it's the same. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I guess this is like the most standard self-testing statement that is known. And okay, so is this does it make sense? Is it clear what is the general theme of things? So essentially we're really trying to figure out, okay, given that I've seen some correlations, what can I say about my system? Okay? And you might think, oh, this is a very hard question, because maybe there is a lot of systems that give these correlations. And I think in general that'll be true, it's just there are some very special correlations, for example, the correlation that gives you the maximum violation of CHSH, which can be achieved in an essentially unique way. Okay? So there's basically just one way up to these, you know, extra degrees of freedom and local unitaries, which are kind of trivial equivalences that you cannot get rid of because they don't affect the statistics. But except for these equivalences, you know everything. Okay? Yeah?
Is it important that the Hilbert space of A and B is factorizable?
So this is kind of the assumption, yeah. So
the assumption.
Yeah, so okay, so you see, like I'm always working in this paradigm that I have a tensor product structure between them. And you're right, it's if you kind of switch to the commuting operators, you can ask, okay, can I still do self-testing there? But I guess we don't know much about this. But yes, indeed. I guess the reason why people like this commuting, this tensor product paradigm is because once you have tensor product, it's meaningful to talk about entanglement. And I guess this was really the original motivation, like certifying entanglement, you know, without assuming the measurements or whatever, you know, just by from the statistics, certify entanglement. And I guess when you want to certify entanglement, it's natural to have the tensor.
Presumably, you can introduce entanglement entropy even if your system is, I don't know, some gauge theory thing.
Presumably, presumably you can, but I mean, I wouldn't know how to do it, and I think, yeah.
What's the difficulty with at least in finite dimension? It should be the same, like the commuting paradigm and the tensor product.
So the correlations that you get are indeed. It's the same set of correlations,
yeah.
but the problem is, like, you know, if I give you a state in the commuting paradigm,
mm-hmm.
and I say this is a state between Alice and Bob,
mm-hmm.
like how do you quantify how much entanglement there is in such a state? Mm-hmm. I think if you don't have the tensor product structure,
so
I think if you wanted to quantify entanglement, I would also have to tell you what are the measurements of Alice and Bob, because they will kind of define some
entanglement is related to a factorization. Yes.
Well, exactly.
Are there any other interesting properties you might be interested in, like have people studied?
No. But I think also that's because I guess this field is predominantly kind of like people working on these things. I think they come mainly from the physics background or the quantum information physics, and I think for them this is just a very natural model to study. But I agree, like self-testing in the commuting paradigm, like. It's interesting, but I think there's essentially nothing, no.
There's difficulty in talking about the state and entanglement of the state,
yeah.
In the commuting paradigm. Could you still reuse some of your results for properties of the measurements in the commuting paradigm?
I think you could, yes. Yes. So I think this, indeed. Is there what, sorry?
The reduction. Like if you have the commuting variables and the product, I know you can go back and forth, the finite domain. But is that unique?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I only know that the sets are the same.
Yeah, yeah.
But how, you know, this one.
Let's say it was some kind of unique, like an isomorphism or something,
mm-hmm.
that self-testing thing should just port over.
Should, yes.
But do people really care about commuting?
It's not the same people. It's different people that care about commuting. Okay. Okay. Anyway, so this is the self-testing for CHSH, and I guess people have developed other self-testing results, and maybe I just give you one more example of this. So this is called the tilted CHSH. Okay. And it's called tilted CHSH because it's basically CHSH with a small correction, okay? Okay, so again, I define my Bell functional just by writing down the operator. And you can see that the operator is essentially the same as before. So I have the second part, but I'm also allowing a marginal term. Okay, and this marginal term, it turns out that it actually changes quite a lot. So the interesting case is where this alpha is between 0 and 2, okay? So you can see that 0 is just the CHSH case, so we already understand this. But the rest of this family is kind of interesting. You can show that the local value is just 2 plus alpha, but the quantum value is 8 plus 2 alpha squared square root, okay? So you can kind of see that whenever we are in this range, there is a difference between them, so that's good. And you can also see that, well, 2 is precisely the point where these two expressions coincide. So this is where it's no longer interesting, okay? Because the two values start to coincide, so you cannot really distinguish classical from quantum, so it's not interesting, okay? But in this whole range, it is interesting. And I guess you can ask, okay, so how do you actually achieve this maximum value? And okay, we know how to achieve it. One way of doing it is by measuring a 2-qubit state. But now this 2-qubit state will be partially entangled. Okay, so it turns out that the optimal state, well, for this inequality, okay, so it's just a partially entangled 2-qubit state. Okay, and you can ask, well, okay, what is the relation between, I guess, the amount of entanglement and the coefficient alpha? And it turns out that the relation looks like this. Okay, so I guess the exact form of this expression is maybe not so important. What is important is that, you know, if we plug in alpha equals 0, we are back to the CHSH case, and indeed we find that sine 2 theta is 1, so theta is pi over 4, so this is indeed the maximally entangled state. Okay, but then when we increase alpha, the right hand side will decrease, and so the sine will become lower and lower, and we can basically go all the way to 0. Well, except the 0 is no longer interesting, but we can be arbitrarily small. So in some sense, by covering all these inequalities, we cover all partially entangled 2-qubit states, okay? So you say, well, this is nice. You know, I have Bell inequalities, which are maximally violated not by the maximally entangled state, but by some other state. So I guess this was the original motivation for looking at these. But then people actually showed that, just like before, this is essentially the only way of achieving the maximum violation, okay? So basically, you could write the same kind of self-testing statement like we have above here for these inequalities, just that, you know, the state will be different and also the measurements are a bit different, but it really has the same flavor. Like, if you see the maximum violation, you basically know exactly what your state is and what your measurements are. So it allows you to certify things. Does that make sense? Is that okay? Mm-hmm. So this is the tilted family, and I guess I wanted to show you one more family, but since we're kind of running out of time, so maybe I'm just gonna.
Just to clarify, the tilted family, it's change in the quantum state, but it's the same measurements.
No, different measurements. Yeah. So. So the measurements of Alice, they look the same. So they look like. I think they actually look like Z and X. Okay. But the measurements of Bob, the degree of incompatibility depends on alpha. So for alpha equals 0, they are like maximally incompatible. But then when alpha increases, they become more and more compatible. So yeah. So having seen this family, of course, there is plenty of kind of, you know, things that you might ask. And I just want to give you a very, you know, quick explanation of like what is known beyond that and what are the interesting research directions that people are pursuing these days. So I guess the first question you might ask is, okay, so far we've only looked at the scenario with two inputs, two outputs, and always what we ended up with was a 2-qubit state, okay? And also maybe just to clarify, so I called this section like self-testing of 2-qubit systems, but what I meant is that what you end up with, so what you end up certifying, so like kind of the ideal state this is a two-qubit system, okay? So there was no assumption about what the actual real state is. This can be like high dimensional and I know nothing about it. But what I kind of end up certifying, what I end up isolating from this big state is a two-qubit state, okay? So now a natural question is, well, can you come up with inequalities in which what you certify is more than two qubits? Is this maximally entangled state of three qubits or five qubits or you know, higher dimensional systems? And of course, this is an important questions, and there is a couple of ways of doing it. Maybe do you have a question? Yeah.
So, am I correct that what you certified is that you had a state?
Yes. Yeah. So okay. So this is another important point. So indeed, since we only rely, okay. So I guess there is this. Whenever I say that I have my boxes and they produce some probability distribution, there is the implicit assumption that, okay, I can really run the experiment many times. Every time I run it, it's the same state that's being produced and the same measurements. And so then I'm just going to kind of try to figure out what that state is. Of course, under this assumption, you can say, well, since I still have the devices, I can just press the button one more time and I should have the state again. But indeed, like I can only certify like what I used in my experiment, but of course I don't have it anymore because I.
Because you know, like when you talk, say about fault tolerance,
yes,
you certify that the state you have is you know a good one.
Yes,
you can use it later.
Yes, so okay, so in this, so I think in the self-testing setup, there is a way of doing it where you basically, if you kind of. You know, because in here, you say, okay, I just receive a classical outcome A and B, and that's it. The state is gone. But you could consider, and actually people have considered setups where instead of thinking of this as a complete measurement process, you think it's a channel that does a partial measurement, but still spits out a quantum system. And then you can try to kind of certify that, you know, given what you see, maybe there is still some entanglement in your state. Okay. Yeah. So exactly. So this would be using weak measurements. But actually, now I'm thinking about this. Yeah. So exactly. So it's because, of course, you know, like this is like fully adversarial setup. Okay. So in some sense, every like quantum system that you don't like that you cannot measure, you cannot like access, it could be total junk. So I think in that case, maybe there is no way of saying that. Yeah, I mean, of course,
the fault tolerance example is not like that, right?
It's a difference.
It's not fully adversarial.
Yeah, so I think that's.
Yeah.
You're allowed
yeah.
to zoom more, so
yeah.
you can
yeah.
probably do.
Yeah.
Is that a state you have?
Well,
you just know that there are errors, and
you basically, you know, put some limitations on what the errors you can have, how many errors you can have.
I mean, of course, also in this setup, you could introduce, instead of kind of saying, look, I'm going to test every round of my protocol, I'm just going to test some of the rounds, okay? And then you can try to play this trick where, based on the rounds that you have measured, you draw conclusions about the rounds that you haven't measured. But, of course, then things become much more complicated. Because in that case, you know, there is always, I mean, in that case, essentially, you cannot, like, this IID assumption, which makes everything very easy, because you say, well, I just do it as many times as I want, and I get exactly this number, this doesn't really work. Because if you only measure some subset, there is always a chance that, like, what you see is extremely different than what you didn't measure, and you always have to, so your statement will always have to allow for this possibility that you just took. The statistics you see do not represent the reality. And so, you know, of course, the statements you can make have to be much more complicated. Okay, so I guess, yeah. So the first question is what happens with high dimensional systems? And it turns out that actually it's not as bad as you might think. So basically there is this. So suppose that what I want to certify is a maximally entangled state of two qutrids. Okay, so it's simply this. Okay, and you might think, okay, how am I going to do this? Well, the observation is that suppose that Alice and Bob locally project on the 0, 1 subspace locally, okay? Then basically you realize that, okay, this term will go away. So essentially what they're left with are these two terms, and they locally just look like a maximally entangled state of two qubits, okay? So basically I'm going to design my procedure such that I'm going to ask Alice and Bob to, you know, project locally on this, and once they have projected on this subspace, they can use this part of the state to maximally violate CHSH. Okay? This would be like one branch in my self-testing procedure. And then the other branch would be to project on the 1-2 subspace. Okay? And then I'm here. And then again, I can violate CHSH, okay, maximally. And basically, by designing a procedure in which I'm exploring both of these two branches, and then by looking at the right statistics, if they can really satisfy, like, you know, observe correlations that are consistent with this, they can really certify that they have a maximally entangled state of two qutrids now. Okay, so in some sense, it turns out that these qubit results can be combined in a way that allows you to certify higher dimensional systems. Okay, and in fact, this can be generalized to any pure bipartite state. If I write the state that I want to certify just in the Schmidt form, where I have C0, 0 plus C1, 1, 1, C2, 2, 2, and so on. So basically any pure bipartite finite dimensional state, I can always play this game where, you know, Alice and Bob will project on these subspaces. And in here, again, I would either project on this subspace or project in this subspace, or project on this subspace, okay? And again, if I see the statistics which are consistent with all of this, then I can actually conclude that this is the state I have, okay? So one way of doing it would be just through by kind of building up on the qubit results and then extending it, and this works. This is a very nice procedure, because you can really, you choose what state you want to certify, and then you just you design your procedure. So essentially, you just have to know how these coefficients are related. Then you kind of have to match them with the tilted inequality, which is here, right? Because the ratio of these coefficients will tell you what kind of partially entangled two qubit state you have, and then we have to match these things, but then you can actually do it, okay? So this is very nice. The drawback of this is that because everything relies on these qubit results, so you might actually be missing some stuff which is inherently high dimensional, okay? And one of the things that you're definitely missing is the so-called transposition ambiguity or transposition problem. And this is actually it's a very nice thing. Basically, if I give you a quantum realization which consists of a state, measurements on Alice, and measurements on Bob, one thing I can always do, I can take a transpose of everything, like a full transpose, okay? So I'm gonna take a full transpose of my state. I'm gonna take a transpose of my measurement operators on each side. Okay, and it's very easy to check that when you take the trace to compute the probabilities, both of these things will actually give rise to the same probability point. Okay, so in some sense, if I give you a realization, you can give me another one which gives the same statistics, and then you can ask, well, are these two things equivalent in some sense? And it turns out that, for example, if my realization, if this is like a state of two qubits, and I only have two possible measurement settings, just like in all these examples, it's kind of like I have two vectors on a block sphere, and so they have a, you know, they make a certain angle, and then I transpose it. Well, transpose on a block sphere is just a reflection, okay? But essentially, if I have two vectors, I reflect them. Well, I still get two vectors. They still have the same angle. So in some sense, I can just undo everything by applying a unitary, okay? So in these simplest examples, this transposition is not a problem because this ambiguity is already covered by the local unitaries, okay? But if I'm in a more complicated example where my, for example, I have three possible measurement settings, okay? And the measurements of Alice correspond to x, y, z, okay? Well, if I transpose them, I'm gonna get x minus y, z, okay? And are these two sets unitarily equivalent to each other? Can I apply a rotation to go from these three guys into the other three? If I care about like preserving the order of things. So the answer is no, and it's really it like you see it just by kind of just by realizing that once you have three matrices, three Pauli matrices in some order, it kind of defines a handedness of your system, okay? It's either right-handed or it's left-handed. So essentially doing this transpose will flip that. So it's kind of clear that you cannot just undo it by a unitary. So these are two inequivalent realizations that nevertheless give rise to the same statistics. So basically, whenever you make a self-testing statement in this more complex scenario, you kind of have to be ready that this might be something that appears, okay? There might not be just one realization, but there is two inequivalent ones. And so in your statement, you have to allow for that, okay? So in the end, you will end up with some kind of direct sum decomposition of the left-handed solution and the right-handed solution. And this is something that you do not see if your results kind of rely on these low-dimensional results, okay? So I'm saying this is very nice because it's kind of versatile. You can certify any state you want, but you might be missing some interesting, like from the point of, you know, fundamental self-testing features, just because you're just lifting low-dimensional results to higher dimension. Okay, so this is one thing. Maybe another thing that I want to say, because we're supposed to finish at 2. Okay. Well, okay, so I guess this that doesn't leave me very much time. So I think this is, I wanted to say one or two more things, but they are all, they are all kind of just recent developments, so it's not clear if they are important or not. But okay, so I guess maybe just to finish.
Quick follow-up on this.
Sorry? Yeah, of course.
This ambiguity relating to the other realization with the transpose.
Yeah.
This is only if you're trying to certify the measurements, but if your goal is just to certify the state, it doesn't come
into. Yes, because, so for bipartite states, you can always bring them to the Schmidt basis, which is kind of transposition invariant. So indeed, so bipartite states, like for the state, you will never see this problem. But already when you go to tripartite states, there are states which for which the state and its transpose are not unitarily equivalent, like local unitarily equivalent. And then it's not clear what to do. So for states, you have to go through more parties. But for measurements, you just have to go to more settings and you already see it. Yeah. Yeah?
So in talking about Valerio's paper.
Yeah.
Is there a thing out there? Anyway, I think they did this trick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they claim they can self-test any
pure bipartite state. This is precisely, no, so this is the paper I'm talking about. So this is Colladangelo, Go, Scarani.
Okay.
Yeah, all pure bipartite states.
But this problem is a problem with their paper as well, right?
Well, so because their results rely on qubit statements, which do not have this problem because qubits are too simple to exhibit this problem, so the transposition never shows up, okay?
Sorry, it does or doesn't?
It does not.
Right, but it should.
Well, no, because, okay, so look, so it's because, like, what I'm saying here is it's not like, you know, whatever measurements you take, they will always be non-unitarily equivalent. It's just, it's a possibility that it will be. But if you choose your, just imagine you're on a block sphere, like, okay, here, if you have three, mutually unbiased measurements on a block sphere, then there is some kind of notion of handedness. But like, suppose you choose all your measurements in a plane, okay? Then there's no notion. You can take a reflection and you will get the same thing.
Okay.
So it's really like, if your choice of measurements like has some special symmetry that basically defeats this transpose problem, then you will not see it. And that's precisely what happens when you tailor your strategy to result, like, you know, you build your strategy out of low dimensional results that do not have this problem. So, okay, so let's say, I'm not saying it's clear that if you take these results and combine them, you will not have this problem, but in their case, you don't have this problem. And I think this is something quite non, so I think generically, you should run into this, okay? Because generically, I think if you take some measurements and you ask, okay, are they unitarily equivalent to their transpose? I think generally, no. I think, you know, because you really have to choose them in a very, I mean, just think about a block sphere. I think in the block sphere, if you have three binary observables, like, they have to be on a plane if they are to be equivalent, and if they are not, they are not, and of course, generically, they are not in a plane. So I guess I was just saying this as a way of saying that, okay, I mean, importing low-dimensional results to higher dimensions is very useful, but there are other phenomena that you will not see simply because you're building it out of two simple blocks. Yeah? Okay, so I think this is a good place to stop. So I guess my intention here was to give you a little bit of background on what is the idea of self-testing and why it's useful. And what kind of systems we can self-test. And so I didn't have time to talk about the recent developments, but of course, if you're interested, please find me. I'm here until the end of the next week. And so, well, thanks a lot for your attention, and thank you very much.